Welcome, everyone. I want to give a shout out to our friends from Kensington East, West Virginia. Raise your hands if you're with us. And also my friend Phoebe from college is here. Where are you, Phoebe? So welcome to all of you. We're happy to have you with us. Celebration of Black History Month. I want to remember Rosa Parks, who was born on February 4th, 1913. She died in 2005. Rosa Parks did not stay in her seat on the bus on that infamous day because she was tired. Rosa Parks refused to rise as pre-planned because she was a fearless warrior for social justice. I hope she's resting in peace. Cordell, take it on.
All right. Just thank you, everyone. I'm going to call you guys the Stalwart 60. It's the 60 of us gathered here because this content is heavy. I'll say it that way. And if we're honest, we're going to suffer a little bit while we work through this because it is the original sin of this country that we're talking about. And that's not a small thing because it still persists to this minute. So we have work to do, but we need to understand it. We need to understand, it's like if I go to the doctor, he doesn't just give me a bottle of pills. He goes, well, let's take some x-rays. Let's do some diagnostic work so we know what's wrong. This book speaks very much to the fundamental malady of this country. So specifically that if we digest it, we can then begin to think fruitfully about what kind of things we have to do. So I appreciated the work. I appreciated its comprehensiveness, and it is a lot. It's a tome. But on the other hand, like the doctor with some really good x-rays and good scans, he go, okay, here's, now we can see what we have to do. We see what's wrong. We see what's hurting. And I appreciate it from that perspective, but it was a difficult read. Because no matter what I'm reading, there's a part of my brain that has a certain amount of disbelief. It's like, really, how can this be? That's what I keep saying. How could this be? And yet it is. I grew up in the South. It is. I grew up in Tennessee. It's real. But it still is unbelievable, nevertheless. So the way I'd like to do this is we'll do a quick overview. I could not give you a comprehensive summary in the time we have, but I will touch on some points. A small number will select from a number of the chapters what would be probably, if you were to triage, what's the most important, and some of the details obviously we'll have to get later. This will not be me talking the whole time. The real value of a community is to have 60 minds with those 60 lenses contributing those 60 people's experience, and we'll leave smarter than if you get one person's perspective. I mean, I'm not pretending to be the Einstein of social problems, so that's not what this is, okay? And so feel free to contribute, feel free to offer things that move your heart, feel free, and I will make sure that you are heard. So just to begin, I wrote a quick statement.
Cordell, can I just
not about the book,
interrupt you for a second? Quick second. Yes. If a meaningful question pops up, please use your participants list and down the bottom to raise your hand because there are three screens. We've got a lot of people, and there's no way Cordell or I or Camille can be able to see screen by screen if you're just waving on the screen. So at the bottom in the participants list, there should be a raise hand. And we'd appreciate if you do that. And then we could see your question much more. I'm sorry, Cordell, I didn't mean it.
Oh, that's fine. And I would say do both. Do the software and wave your hand. Either one. You can't overwave.
I don't see it at the bottom of my participant list.
Andrea, what do you have?
It's under reactions now.
Oh. It depends on which version of Zoom you have. If you have an older version, it's at the bottom. If you click on participants, and then you'll see it on the underneath that participants list. If you have a newer version, you click on reactions and there's a bar that says raise hand, and that's the same thing.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Appreciate that. So just a statement about orientation. I want this to be not policy driven, but heart driven. And I think the mistake we sometimes make is we think policy is the answer policy only speaks to what the heart has committed to. So I want to talk about the heart first and not policy. So I want to say, let's presume that all progress is going to be rooted in the pursuit of true empathy. At the core of this, we can't do anything if we're not coming from a place of true empathy. It's not law, it's our feeling. So we're birthing a predisposition or bias. We're trying to create this new predisposition or new bias to find ourselves feeling affinity and care before a thought even occurs. Before we even begin to think, we should learn how to feel care before we've started thinking. We need to reverse that, because we want to live from the heart, from the spirit. And that's when we become human. So it's not a decision or an ongoing experience like a heartbeat. Well, it is like that, actually. What I'm suggesting is that when we're in the right place, it's what happens to us and not what we do intentionally. If I see Lonnie bump into something and bruise herself and wince, I'm not thinking, should I frown? Should I even suggest that? I mean, immediately my body responds. Immediately I'm going to feel what's happening with her. And that's where we're trying to arrive, is those qualities of our being that let us connect to people. Because without those connections, we are not going to act forcefully. So that's I'm just suggesting, let's be prepared to feel. Let's be prepared to not just think and reason, but let's be prepared to connect with people and go to their pain. Then we have a chance. So it will become a part of our nature that we care. If we practice this, it becomes part of our nature. And we can train this, we can make this, we can cultivate this in our community. And if we do that, we can expect and hope that we'll be emulated outside of our community. So first of all, this book is historical as much as it is explanatory. None of the history that's reported is accidental or incidental. None of it is accidental. It didn't just happen. This system that we're going to talk about was engineered. It was engineered with intention. And it's going to take a similar level of commitment to engineering to fix it. It won't be from somebody's proclamation. It won't be saying nice things. We're going to have to organize our resources in the same way that we got to the moon, in the same way that we waged World War II or whatever. That level of engineering is necessary because the scope of the problem is so large. We're not talking about a community problem. We're talking about a global problem. So I'm preparing us to address the scope of the work that needs to be done. And if we're not at that scope, we're fooling ourselves, okay? That's my opinion though, I'm not, again. So we as our community though, in our action here, I think of it as us priming the pump of justice. In our community, we're gonna siphon a flow of healing from where we are, and we have to assume that our growth will be seen and emulated. So we're not, what we're doing is real, and the ripples, we should not pretend to predict where they will go. We just have to walk our walk, okay? In terms of focus, I'm gonna do a quick summary or a light summary, but it's highly selective and not expected to leave you as if you had read the real book. That's not possible right now, but at least we can focus on the highlights. So I'll do a quick cover of some of the key chapters and some points from those. And then I will ask you questions. I want to know what your reactions are. What are your responses to this? Those who did read it and those who got a gist of it, doesn't matter. I want to know what your reactions are. That's important because I don't want to pretend that I know where everyone is. And if we're going to act together, it's important for me to get a sense of where we are as a community. So I'm going to ask some questions, and don't feel put on the spot if I ask you something. And it's okay. We're not here judging. We're not here trying to perform. We're just here to offer whatever we have to offer. Let's see. So cast. the author begins with a metaphor of a medical metaphor, actually, and associated with the emergence of the COVID virus, for instance, and suggests that even when we have treated a problem, an infectious incident, it doesn't mean we've eradicated it forever. It means that we may have pushed it into remission, but we must stay vigilant because resurgence can happen. And we've seen that. Those historians will know that after the Civil War and after the burden of slavery was temporarily lifted, there was then a backlash as the South and its failing economy realized that in order to rescue their livelihoods and way of life, they had to put in place again the essential features of the system that was in slavery. So it's the same thing, but with a mask, with a cover. But they reinstituted that in order to, again, keep making the money and keep being in charge. So the first chapter kind of talks about that, and it's not really necessary for us to dig into that, but that was the gist of that chapter. Also, caste is not something unique to this country. So for those who don't know, let me give you my takeaway definition of caste. We are programmable beings. When we say the word education or when we say the word learning, what we're saying is that we have the capacity to introduce into our neurology, into our cognitive processes, behaviors that once learned and internalized essentially are automatic. To the extent that even the speech, when I'm forming sentences and telling you these words, it's happening as I think about what I mean, the process happens. So we're talking about automatic parts of our system, automatic parts of our behavior. In the same way that that's automatic, our appreciation and interpretation of our world is automatic. So my father was a dog whisperer, and all my experiences with dogs were wonderful because he could make them almost human. So my understanding of dogs, even without thinking, is that they can be friendly and they will love you unconditionally and they are helpful and smart. I have a cousin who was bitten by a dog when he was little. And when he sees a dog, he sees something else completely different. And there's no way for me to critique how he sees it. That's just as right as what I'm experiencing. But my point is that all that is built into us automatically. So when he sees a dog, he's ready to run. His body goes into fight flight mode and he's ready to get down the road. And I'm like, come here, puppy, come here, you know, completely different worlds. So the caste is built into us at that level. And we have learned from our experiences, from our community, from intentional teaching, as well as from observing, we've absorbed a reality perspective. Caste refers to that part that establishes the rules and the place for people in our society. What are the rules and place? And the most well-known example of that is India, where they have castes that can go back for generations. And if you're born in the lower caste, there's nothing you can do about it. It's God's will. For some reason, your karma has put you there and there's no reason to fight it. And in fact, it's right that you're there because obviously you have something to learn if you're in the lower caste. But if you're in the higher caste, you're being rewarded. You have arrived, you have attained something worthy of virtual worship. And that's with you forever. So this caste story is the way we've learned to sort out people, their roles, their activities, and it's not negotiable. So put it differently, we're in a container and you've learned the rules of that container and it tells you who you are, what you can expect, who you can talk to in certain ways and who you cannot. And that's top to bottom. And it's strictly enforced, which is to say, the other outstanding feature of the caste is that it is enforced by the participants as if God has willed it so. So if you step out of line, all those around you will not have any problem with putting you back in line as if it's God's will. It is just so. So this definition is not the same as racism, which is more or less more amorphous, more soft. We talk about working on our institutional bias or our personal bias and all those kinds of things. And it's something we consider we can change. Well, caste is not flexible like that. These are, in a sense, treated as immutable laws. So that's why she used that title and makes the argument in the book that the way we do groups is more akin to caste and the definition of caste than to racism. So she intentionally says, this is not racism. This is a structure that was put in place with reasons and enforced in the same way as that multi-millennial system of India. It is about thousands of years operating in that same way. And I think the idea of that is once we understand the way it's sustained and maintained, then we can have a chance of not being deluded as we try to disassemble it. We have to understand the depths of it. And it's rooted in our unconscious. It's rooted in our precognitive behavior. Does that make sense? It's rooted where we're acting before we've thought. That's why I use the dog metaphor. Before my cousin even thinks the word dog, his body's already running. He's not choosing, it's done. And what my reaction is, I'm already having a nice warm experience before I've even thought about it. So these are buried deep in our psyche. And it's important for us to understand that that's how we're built. If we misunderstand the way the human system works, we're not gonna fix it in the proper way. So I'm only saying that to say that if we really do address these problems, we have to understand that we're reprogramming, which means what? Repetition. You have to really condition over an extended period of time in order to build a behavior and allow other behaviors to extinguish. So psychology has a great deal to say about how we have to change. And if somebody says you can hear a speech and walk away different, they're mistaken. You will have to, one, accept a matriculation through a system or a process. You've got to accept that it's going to take some time and some effort. And if we get it right, we may come out freer from those programs that we've absorbed and integrated into our being. So I don't want to say that. Don't feel bad if you still catch yourself with your own biases, whatever they may be. If you still find that they don't just go away because you said so, that's not how we're built. Nature has made everything that we believe is important, has made it happen almost independent of your momentary decisions, because whatever we've decided is important, it's going to essentially take out of the momentary conversation and make it what happens immediately before you've thought. And there's some evolutionary reasons for that, but I'm going to not go there. And let's just say these are behaviors with roots. This interpretation of the world has roots. She'll give you many examples where she travels a lot, and she oftentimes would speak of, when I say she, Isabel Wilkerson, that the author, will talk about an experience where, for instance, she got on, she's at home and she's called a plumber to fix something, you know, the pipe is broken in the basement. Well, the plumber comes to the door, looks at her and says, may I speak to the lady of the house? Well, you know, we saw this with Professor Gates. His man is in his own house, but what's in the people, what's in the policeman, whomever's in the community, what's in their system is they obviously would not be there. They don't belong there. I know the rules. And so they're in a place where I treat them as the servant, the helper. And these things happen and they're built into us. And you may find yourself with certain similar biases, and don't feel bad that you can't catch it the first time, but we will train them out if we're doing the right thing. But her book is replete with examples of those programs and how they collide. They collide often. I am a high-tech trainer. I've trained people in Fortune 500 companies for the last 30 years. But even when I come into a meeting, almost every time somebody looks at me and wonders why I'm there, I have to spend the first 10 minutes trying to dazzle and amaze for them to go, OMG, he really knows something. Any of you, particularly white males, could walk into a room and they would never wonder if you belong there and if you know something. They would presume it. But in my case, I have to demonstrate it over and over with mental gymnastics. And that's just part of this story that's built into us in so many layers and in so many ways. Kathy, you can speak to this. Kathy is a woman engineer. I cannot imagine her life is like always trying to convince the smart boys that she belongs. I can appreciate an imagined experience that she's having from mine, but I don't know exactly. It wouldn't be right for me to think I know her life, but I know she's having this a similar dish, you know, a similar experience. Okay, so the title of chapter two, or part two actually, which has several chapters, is The Arbitrary Construction of Human Divisions. The point is, we have a society that doesn't treat it as arbitrary, but we have to allow and admit that it is. For those who read 13, or saw the movie 13, they reveal something of the structure of those arbitrary features and where they come from. And the rationale is, we're building a new world. We need labor resources. We need somebody to work the land. We need following things, but I could either pay someone for it or I can take it if I have the power. And the way the United States chose to do it was to use the power of being willing to use violence to then build a country, which meant taking a person's body, taking their life, and making them know that either they do what they comply or they die. And that's what we built this country on. So without talking about reparations, we should just at least understand that that's the structure that was put in place from the beginning and reinforced whenever necessary throughout the social ups and downs of this country, throughout the abolitionist movement, but then a backlash after the Reconstruction, and then a backlash after World War II, and then a backlash. It keeps resetting this same arrangement of your job is to do what I tell you, and my job is to enjoy life. And that's the structure. And it's arbitrary, but it's enforced incredibly to the extent that when you watch the news, and you've seen the news where white boys went to Washington and surrounded one of the monuments of democracy and could walk around with weapons and do whatever they want and break windows. But the peacekeepers, the people who were looking for justice a few months ago, were surrounded with full force of military. And if you step out of line, there would be blood on the streets. That's what we're talking about. That built-in presumption that if you're white, you're right. And if you're not white, well, you better get in line. And that's that arbitrary construction of human divisions. It's hard to find flexibility in that. She goes on to describe the eight pillars of caste. I'm not going to do those because that's a lot of exposition that would be necessary. But she does make the point, though, that it's a profuse, it's insinuated in ways that we cannot underestimate the layers and the intricacy of these connections. So I just want to, having made that point, I don't want to stress it too much longer. The consequences of caste is part five. That's worth pointing out. And I have a couple of these where I actually highlighted some quotes that I thought made sense to point out. So I have to say that because of the amount of information, I've got four different devices, each positioned with some information on it so I can get to it immediately. We're past that, okay. So the consequences of caste. One second, bear with me for one second. So the most and respected and beneficent of society people oversaw forced labor camps that were politely called plantations, concentrated with hundreds of unprotected prisoners whose crime was that they were born with dark skin. Good and loving mothers and fathers, pillars of their communities, personally inflicted gruesome tortures on their fellow human beings. For the horrors of the American Negro's life, wrote James Baldwin, there has been almost no language. So the colonists made decisions that created the caste system long before the arrival of the ancestors of the majority of people who now identify as Americans. The dominant caste controlled all resources, controlled whether and when, if a Black person would eat, sleep, reproduce or live. The colonists created a caste of people who would by definition be seen as dumb because it was illegal to teach them to read or write, in order to justify the bullwhip, and as immoral to justify rape and forced breeding as criminal because the colonists made the natural response to kidnap, floggings, and torture. The human impulse to defend itself or break free, it's a crime if you're Black. So the point is that not accidentally, but in order to suppress for the benefits, these were normalized. These behaviors that we would think as criminal and inhumane were normalized. And that's still the case too, if you actually look at how we're doing things. But I just wanted to say that the consequences of this are felt broadly. She talks about, part of it is that even if you don't agree with that, if you oppose it, you're going to be punished. So there are many stories of abolitionists or folks who in their conscience knew this was wrong. And if they spoke up, they were treated as viciously as those of African descent. And so you have this fairly well-designed system to sort of maintain the status quo of this way of living. There are some medical consequences that I'm not going to cover right now, but if you imagine living under a certain type of stress, like when I go to the doctor, if I'm really concerned about something, when he takes my blood pressure, it's going to be high because I'm actually feeling some angst and stress. If I go there and after a few minutes, he tells me some reassuring things and I calm down, he takes my blood pressure again, it's very low. We are influenced physiologically in lifelong ways by the experiences we're having in our bodies on a day-to-day basis. And so the disparities in health and responses to maladies is really different to those who are living in chronic stress versus those who have occasional stress. So that's just one of the types of consequences that she mentions. But that, again, that's not the heart of the matter. That's just, there are many consequences to this. Let me stop for a second, because I suddenly realized that there's so much information, it could be 2 hours later and I'll still be trying to pull it all together into one nice package. But I want to ask for those who read all our parts, if there are any parts that stood out for you that either you didn't understand and would like clarification on and further discussion about, or just somehow in your own mind is a highlight. I want to open this up to not just me talking, but to get the interaction going.
Cordell, for phase five that you just read, Barbara Woods asked, do you have the page number on that when you just looked at your...
I can do that, but I'm using devices. I may not be paper page number.
Okay, we'll look that up later, Barbara, and find out what pages that was. That
but question. It's in part five. I was just discussing some things in part five on the medical issue. So if you go into table of contents and go and look up part five, it'll take you to the pages and whatever form you raise. Helen, you have a question, or I see your hand is raised. Please.
Yeah, thank you, Cordell. I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time on this, but I've reread the definition of caste and race and how they're different, mm-hmm. but they don't seem that different to me. And race appears to me to be one form of caste rather than they're really that different. That's the first thing. And the second thing is do you think she's saying that caste is something that is inevitable, or the idea of caste for human beings is inevitable? Like we're born with that cognitive structure or whatever structures there are, so that there's no way we cannot put people into hierarchical categories.
Okay, those are two good questions, two excellent questions. So first of all, the distinction between caste and race, she uses an example. Germany was oftentimes used as a nation who had a caste system that emerged around World War II. And there are a lot of parallels in their approach to caste versus race. It seems that you could be partially in the upper layer of the caste if you had qualities or characteristics similar to that group. And so it becomes a something that's flexible. Now, I will forever be African-American. And so if we're talking about race, whatever behaviors are being being dictated by my race, I can't change that. But if it turns out that we have some partial revolution and it turns out there's some admission that we're not right to deal with people based on the color of their skin, it could be that being a fair-skinned Black person allows you to be closer to the upper class than being a dark-skinned Black person. So there's a bit of the option to manipulate those distinctions to say that, well, you got more white blood in you than Black blood, so maybe we'll let you participate. So they had some funny rules where if you were like three parts white, you could get benefits where if you were, but in America, if you have any Black at all, you cannot benefit. So there's different ways that a group can choose to use caste and define caste. Race is not something we could fudge like that, but we can change the rules of caste if it turns out it's for our political benefit to do so. And we sometimes see that. One of the funny things that sometimes occurs to Black folks is that we find a few of our members going over and becoming Trumpers or becoming Proud Boys. And we go, what in the world could that be about? But it turns out that if they are perceived to have qualities consistent with the ruling group, they might be given some of those benefits. And in fact, one of the rules of the caste system is if you can use some of your own to police yours, it's good too. So you get those for benefits, a little more security. They got finer features or something. They get to be safer, but provided they help keep the rest down. So there's some complications around strict racism based on ethnicity versus the rules that we bend and change and fudge in order to make sure we have enough people to suppress those that we want to suppress. So
thank you. Yes. We have Sheldon has a question, then Reverend Jay Atkinson, and then Christina. So we have Sheldon, Jay, and Christina. Sheldon, you want to unmute and ask your question?
Yeah, it still confuses me, caste and race, because for instance, in Nazi Germany, you couldn't be a little bit Jewish and not be in a concentration camp. You could be a helper of the guards and pick out the people to be exterminated, but you weren't going to be able to leave any concentration camp or even perhaps survive. On the other hand, some of it seems like it's sort of splitting hairs, because when it comes, well, like now, we have a new group, we have a group of people who are attempting to take over, to run the country. And they're using racism once again to bolster their ranks and give cause to their cause. So I can understand in terms of using what's been inculcated in us, but it's, it's the same old story. I don't see, and in Germany, the German anti-Semitism came out of eugenics, which was about race.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, human beings rationalize, try to find a rationalization for why things are the way they are. So therefore people are mistreated because they deserve it in some way. So anyway, I don't know, but it's
I'm going to suggest that the distinction between caste and race is difficult to make precise. In the discussion around how caste was applied in Nazi Germany, it turns out that for a while though, if you had three of your grandparents were German, you had one Jewish grandparent, you still could be German. So that for a while, it wasn't just if you had a drop of Jewish blood, it was, well, let's see what it says, but that's because they still needed a little political stance to include some people that may have had some value. So it wasn't black and white and it didn't happen instantaneously. But that's an example of the kind of fudging that you can do. It's like you go, well, I've got three white grandparents and one Jewish grandparent, so I'm good, you know, and that was the case for a while. And it could be that the war effort modified that, and I'm not recalling clearly, but that's certainly one of the factors. And I, and by the way, Helen had the other part of her question I want to touch on briefly is I don't think that Wilkerson is saying that caste and the behaviors around caste is inevitable. She's not saying that. And she cites Germany and India and the United States as her prime examples, but each one has distinct differences, but it's still based upon the arbitrary division of groups, one group being the beneficiary of the resources and labors and lives of another group. And in India, in Germany, and in the United States, that's the underlying thing, is that we have group separation, and one group is in one role and another group is in another role, and that's just the way it is. And that's what caste means. And it can survive for millennia because it's handed down. And when I say handed down, that implies that it's in the unconscious of the participants. It's the reality that we realize we're in before we even choose.
Thank you.
And I think any distinctions to say it's based on race or not based on race probably wastes our energy and time, because I think in our guts, we know that the race is a part of it in America. Ethnicity is part of it in the German system. In India, it wasn't even about race. They were all Aryans, but it had to do with physical characteristics. And those physical characteristics justified the behavior. You were obviously clearly not a Brahmin if you were too dark and your features were not so fine. And then everyone looks at you and immediately knows who you are, what you can do, what can you say, you know, how must you behave? And you have to show obedience because you're unclean and untouchable if you're too dark.
All right, Cordell, we have Ajit who's here from India, and he, I think he can speak to some of
that'd be nice.
The cast. Yeah, so I don't completely agree that, like, on the Aryan principles, because it's a matter of time and history. So all of India is not Aryan.
Okay.
So the origin of caste in India started 50, if you have to go, and this is where, like, when you talked about scope, Cordell, and time, it makes me even more nervous, because it was 1500 BC when the Aryan tribes came in from Europe into northern India and subjugated the existing indigenous people there who were of darker skin. 1500 BC.
Okay.
And it is, again, human nature that a race and a people that came in subjugating the people who were there for their own benefits and saying you have a caste system in which the people that who were there and whom they had conquered were in the lowest caste, and they were told it's God's will that you'll always be in the lower caste and you'll always be so. Doesn't that ring something to what happened in United States and everywhere else?
Yes, these are immutable assignments. Yes, absolutely.
So I think there is a mix of race and of power.
Yes.
So, but even in India, it is based upon race lines. And it's scary to me that, like, we're talking about 1500 BC with white Aryan races subjugating a darker race in India.
Wow. Thank you, Ajit.
Thank you.
Reverend Atkinson, you had a question, and then we'll go on to Christina and then to Bob.
Thanks, Lonnie. I had a couple of reactions. One of the things, I appreciate you're lifting up the highlights, Cordell, but for me, the impact of the book was the way that these examples just pile up on top of each other. And it's just the overwhelming weight of her examples. That is the impact of the book for me. On the Nazi question, what really stunned me was, and it was total surprise, sociologists and ethnologists studied Jim Crow dynamics in the United States in order to learn how they might employ the same kind of stuff in the suppression of Jews and gays and others in their own society. And the thought that we were the United States Jim Crow era was the model for a lot of what they did was just awful.
Yes.
And the third thing, your example about the plumber coming to the home and asking for the lady of the house. If you've been to our General Assembly, almost every year there's some example of some Unitarian Universalist approaching a Black person in the hotel via U delegate, but assuming that that person is a hotel employee. Yeah. And yeah, so it's an example of how deeply we're infected.
Yes.
So those are my thoughts.
And you got what she wanted you to get. So there are so many examples. It's completely demoralizing in a way to read example after example, because each one is heartbreaking in and of itself. But I think if we don't face that, we don't respond. So I started to gather a few statistics. For instance, I said, I wonder how many people have been lynched. How many in the news, we hear about the occasional shootings, but we don't know how many. We don't really, because it seems incidental, like, okay, another one happened last week. So I just went to check how many lynchings happened between 1865 and 1950. 6,500 lynchings. 6,500. That means every week somebody was made an example of. Every week they're terrorizing to make sure you know that you shall not step out of line. And these are not just a killing. These are horrific torture parties. I mean, literally, you go, how could we do that? And so you add that to then the shootings. Like, I was watching the news a month ago and they were talking about the latest shooting. They said, but no one's telling you that actually in this year it's been 500 shootings. You just get the one or two on the news. And so it sounds like there's an all-out war that's just not being fully reported. And that looking away is the thing that troubles me most, because to the extent that the blinders are on the American public, those who would do better are not aware. They're ignorant for two reasons. All of your media tells you that Blacks are not as well educated, not as intelligent, lazy, yada, 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 because that's the story you're told from birth. And then on the news, they justify it and support it because somebody gets in economic trouble, gets in trouble because he's trying to figure out how to feed his children, maybe selling drugs, maybe he stole a loaf of bread, goes to prison. And if that's all you're at the beginning, though, it somehow seems right that these people are just not as good as us. And so you have a populace that just believes that those people are not as good as us. And so then they don't use the instruments of justice to remedy it because it seems right. And that's the thing that's very demoralizing too. So I was suggesting that we have to get close to the pain. We have to find the information. And this book is information. Go there, steel yourself, and look directly at it, and let your heart respond. Your heart will say, no more. Then you're ready to join the human race. That's what it is. But it's, again, it's not about law and it's not like conversation. Don't you think that was terrible? We're talking about if you were standing there with a rope around your neck and you know what's gonna happen. What's in your heart? What's in your heart? What did George Floyd, he called for his mother who was dead. I mean, we don't know how to take that last step into the shoes to see the evil. And the distance, there's a lot of psychological studies show that the distance we can sustain between us and the atrocities makes it less likely that we address them. We do terrible things at a distance, but when we get close, we don't. We have to get close together, millions of us, and we can fix it. But if we don't, we cannot. And back to one more point before I give a question, one more point. Yeah. Just, I want to finish up a point. So the guy on the porch, the plumber came into the house, treated her like dirt, let her mop her own floor, just didn't help. And then she called throwing the Hail Mary pass, talk about her mother who she had lost, and began to speak in terms of humanity and a heart language that he felt. And he softened up, he humanized, and he began to be helpful. But it had to do with him identifying with her enough to see her as a human being. And it says to me, that's part of the hope though, is if a person, if we can find identification and connection, there will be movement, but it's not automatic. But it at least gave me a little glimmer of like, you know, even a guy coming in with the programming in force, it was able to be disrupted enough for him to do the right thing and to become more human. Go ahead, Lonnie, who did you have lined up?
And very much what you're saying, Cordell, is what Reverend Kat Cox talked about this morning in her compassion, her talk, that was wonderful. Thank you, Cordell. Christina, you have can you unmute and ask your question? Then we'll have Bob Adams, Karen, and Nikki.
I came into this book very skeptical about her use of caste and the whole idea that she was going to present. And I came out of it utterly convinced. And I think what it does is give us a way to talk about where we are without getting rid of words that are very charged, like racism, because it takes away, racism is treated as if it's a conscious decision. Oh, you have that reaction. As if we think, oh, I'm gonna act a certain way to that person. She is talking about an unconscious built in from the time you are little system, and it's about power. It's not about race, it's about power. And the whole structure we're living in is built on that. Now, one thing about slavery and enslavement in this country was, you know, in Greece, you might've been a slave, but your children weren't necessarily a slave. Here, it was a perpetual system. And there were laws once the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves. There were laws about what profession you could, many states would limit what professions you could be in. So the power structure has been working on this for a long time. But I think she gives us a way to talk about pervasive, unconscious power systems that's even bigger than the way we've used the terms racism before, is to say that this is always going on all the time. The example of Nazi Germany is, I don't think, very helpful because Jews had a life before the Nazis. They had stores, professions, professorships, all of this that was enforced at a certain point. Up to then, you might have had anti-Semitism like you had in the US and France and Germany, wherever. But people had lives, people had achievement. It wasn't until this horror came along that everything was different. And yes, the example of having one drop of African blood determining your life. But I think it's very useful in a way to talk about power and the unconscious placement of who's what and who's whom.
That's brilliant, Christina. Cordell, can you hold till we hear from Bob and Nikki, and then maybe you can combine their conversations with Christina's. Bob, can you take yourself off mute?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I had two comments. I mean, I've got a lot of them, but two of them will suffice. One is, I wanted to speak to Sheldon's comment about being confused about this. And all I suggest to him is he think about what Ajit said when, in, you know, having lived in India for a couple of years, that if you think about it happening, not among white people, but among people who are all brown to one shade or another, then you have to look at that a little differently. So you see that caste is, race is a subset of caste. And yes, in India, the lowest caste people are the shortest and the darkest. And people in the South are darker and shorter than people in the North, where the Aryans were more dominant back in their day. The whole thing there is justified on the basis, first by the Aryans and just in terms of raw power, but they wanted a cover too. So their cover was Hinduism, the religion. If you were a good Hindu, part of it was fulfilling your caste obligations of your caste so that you possibly could be reborn again in another caste, if possible. And the other was in terms of occupation, you know, your profession or employment. You know, there was the Brahmins, the priestly caste, and then the warrior caste, and then the merchant caste, and then the farmer caste, and then. And it was all, you know, so that if you were found your parents doing some kind of job, that's what you were to do. That was you were given that lot in life by God, not by, you know, some political leader or not. The second comment I want to make, and I don't know how this is going to go over in this crowd, the last 2 years before I finally moved to California permanently, I worked for the Chicago Urban League. The coalitions I was coordinator of, we switched where we were housed from a nonprofit downtown to the Chicago Urban League. And I have to tell you that when I wore my best suit, they were very dressed up people, the Urban League, called the Bourbon League. Some people know it by that when the occasions that we all had to wear suits and ties to, I was the shabbiest looking person there. that people just, and so that whole, and this is in the 80s, mid 80s. So the whole period of affirmative action was, you know, really a big thing still. And that, active, supported aspiration to be part of the mainstream corporate culture of Chicago, in any case, which is what I knew about, was very strong there and very impressive. I mean, these were impressive people to me. And I thought I was University of Chicago grad school type, that I knew a thing or two, right? So the point is that the caste system can ensconce itself in virtually any culture. And I think the US has moved, I think it was Jay, the way we're kind of moving to a caste system in regards to, we're not racist anymore because I know this and that black person and I treat them just, fine and so on. But a whole caste system that is multi-generational, which is just like the caste system in India, perpetual.
Thank you, Bob, always. And for the work that you've done in your life, anti-racist and anti-caste work has been amazing. Karen, we have Karen Elliott wants to add to the discussion. Go ahead, Karen.
Thanks, yeah. I read this book last summer, and so my memory may not be so good, but one of the things that stuck with me, Cordell, and that was that it seemed to me that she was saying that it's really part of human makeup to need there to be someone on the rung below us. And that's what stuck with me. And she didn't give a solution to that. In other words, that caste itself and that power that societies work with is built on a human propensity to want there to be somebody on a rung below. And I hope we can talk about that a little bit because that's a disturbing thing. Thank you.
But just let Nikki come in here because I think sure. You'll be able to do a big circle around between Jay and Bob and Nikki and Karen.
Yes, hi. Whenever I thought of caste, I've always thought of India. You know, that's always what came into my mind. And someone also had mentioned how the Nazis took, the model here, in the U.S., to form their own caste system. And I never thought, I thought of India, but never thought like we are living in the caste system in the U.S. and never thought of it as a caste system. And continuing, and I saw also at the beginning of the book, even when Martin Luther King visited India, that he was shocked, when the untouchable, when they welcomed him as part of their family. And so I'm just wondering about that. How can we sit in it? We are part of the system and don't really realize it because, as I said, I just thought of India. And then another thing I wanted to mention is I was born and raised in Haiti, and I'm trying to, I don't know if there's a distinction between caste, the caste and class, because I know in Haiti that the class system is, you know, if you speak French, which is the language of the elite, you know, you automatically has all kinds of privilege. But yet the common people who speak Creole, you know, I mean, you know, they're all the way in the bottom. And so therefore, I don't really see the distinction between caste and class. So if you can, you know, just let me know what you think with that.
Okay. Couple things. To the question of, is caste inevitable? I think that was one of the questions. Is this inevitable? I think that the underpinnings of this strategy, and I'm going to call it a strategy, has to do with scarcity and competing for limited resources. And so some of us will organize together to win the game, to command the resources. And this is one way of doing it. I think if there were bounty, we'd be doing other things. But when we're competing for survival and not only survival, but fine living, we want that, then we're going to organize to compete for that along recognizable and clear group lines, because we need to be easy to manage. So this physical cues are one of the things that let us know how to play the game well. So I don't think that caste is inevitable. And I'll also say, the reason I would also, let me say it this way, I would look for some societies that are not caste driven for counter examples. And we are not living in a world where every society is caste driven. We know that India, US, Germany, and other places to some extent, but it's not universal. So there are places where we've learned to survive without having someone subjugated at the, you know, to the benefit of another. That's not always the case. So it's not automatic. We all have a heart and it beats. That's universal. But I think this caste strategy is not universal, but where there's been harsh survival challenges, it's a solution that emerges from that. And in fact, it's emerging in this country now more powerfully because there've been a generation or two of relative decline of quality of living. And so there's the panic and the freaking out, and we need to consolidate our position now because it's changing. So now we see caste as a strategy becoming more important and followed more vigorously than before. But if it were bounty, we would do different things. I would cross the street and visit my neighbor if it were bounty because they're interesting. I like their differences. They have good music and good food. But if we're competing, then I demonize them and make them, I give myself a reason to eradicate them. So I think it's not simple genetics or something. I think we have a social context out of which caste can take root and it's not automatic. Any other, these are, you guys have better questions than I'm coming up with. So let's keep doing this.
Barbara Woods, do you still have your question that you had posed before? Barbara, you've come off of mute.
Hi. One of the things that I had, it wasn't so much as a question, it was just pretty much, I believe, a statement. Mm-hmm. I truly agree with, I have read the book a few months ago, my book club, that was one of our reads. But there was a difficulty that I had in distinguishing caste versus race, as I think someone had stated earlier, because I see them as so intertwined. And I did realize that in my reading that other countries indeed did learn from us, the USA, about actual caste system. And I think, and what bouncing off of what Cordell just said, I think that one of the issues as to what is going on now is an issue of power and control. And I believe that what is seen now is because the minorities to a degree are now becoming the majority. And that presents a problem, not necessarily anything that has actually been shown, but it is, you base what's going to happen possibly on your behavior. You can only rely on those things that you know or have lived. And I think when you think about, and now I think this may be a little chilling, but that when you look at how another group of people have been treated in the past, by the majority, that majority, of course, is going to be very threatened by that minority becoming in control, thinking, not knowing, just thinking that they will do what they did. Mm-hmm. And that indeed is not necessarily going to happen. But again, you can't change how someone thinks or how someone feels about a certain issue, because all we can do is base it on what we bring into a situation.
Cordell, this is your wife, Lonnie, and she.
Do you have a question, dear? Do you have a question, dear?
She didn't recognize me. Christina said in the chat, she said, class can be changed, but caste cannot. You can change class. And now we have these three words, race, caste, class. Because I know that in Black culture, African-American culture, they set up a class system. It couldn't be caste if we're defining power as with the word caste. They had no power. It was pretend power, but they did a class thing. Oh, I went to Morehouse. Oh, I went to this college and your family's a janitor. I mean, not always, but I'm saying that whole class thing that's in every group, caste thing, race thing. Can you maybe just kind of thread those a little bit apart? Mm.
So I think as social beings, we need some way to execute the strategy. And I think we use features of race and features of class to sort out which team you're on. Because it's in that identification that we consolidate our and integrate and coordinate our activities. So if we identify via education, for instance, in a class model, we still may collaborate and work together because of that commonality. I can't cite the place right now, but there were places where if it became advantageous to admit someone into my caste, became advantageous, then we can modify the caste. For instance, let's look at this economic condition that the world is in right now. If it turns out that the majority swiftly becoming a minority thinks it's worthwhile to admit those who have enough similarity to them so they get their numbers, you can believe they're gonna do it. So Lonnie, you might become part of that upper caste and I might still have to be in the lower caste because I can see you're worthy of benefits. I can see you're worthy of favor. I'm too brown. And so we add numbers to the voting block to expand that shrinking majority. That's something that was cited as a strategy in the caste, in using the caste as an instrument of control. That doesn't mean you have to go with it, honey. Don't do it. Don't listen to it. But that was cited as one of the ways we can get, because again, it comes down to power. And in a democracy, it comes down to numbers.
You know, let's just hear from Roberta, who has worked in systems that have been very interesting for years in India. She and her husband, Dr. Shaw, yes, helped many villages. Roberta, could you talk?
Okay. I'd had my hand raised because I wanted to ask about class, but that was a while back. It's been brought in because that's... one thing I found interesting living in India from the 1969 through 72, and then again from 2006, Frederick was there from 2004 till 2018, and I was in and out. But he was working with Help Project in a slum, and it seemed with the health promoters, the people he'd hired from the slum and trained, there was some discussion and somebody was talking about caste and a couple of the people there said, oh, I'm a Dalit. And others said, oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. And so forth. And it struck us how interesting that on that level of people living in the slum, they weren't so conscious. Now, of course, there were no Brahmins living in the slum. I mean, but I thought how interesting that they were not that conscious or looking down at the next rung below. And it also struck me that as foreigners, Frederick and I had, unless you knew certain names, belonged to Brahmins or something. We didn't know necessarily what caste people were, but I'm sure that most Hindus knew exactly, you know, caste and subcaste and right names. So I just thought, that's interesting. It never occurred to us to be thinking about, well, what, you know, but in class, yes, because some people are very well-to-do, while some are middle class and so forth. And so you could see that. So I don't know that that adds anything to this discussion, but yeah.
Thank you, Roberta. Thank you. Nikki, did we just not put your hand down or you had something else? Because we're going to go on to Gary and then Don Close. All right, so Gary and
You didn't put my hand down. But
okay, all right. So, all right, if you go off mute, Gary and Francine.
Yes, hi. Hi, Cordell, it's Francine. There were two things that I was responding to. One was the question of whether a hierarchy is inevitable. And my thought was that perhaps given the development of humanity from the small family and clan point of origin, xenophobia may be a kind of built-in instinct. And xenophobia would define a group of outsiders as well as a group of insiders. And in order to protect and sustain the insiders, you would demote to the status of often enemy, those who didn't fit. And perhaps to that extent, having someone under you is, if not inevitable, a very deep-seated instinct. That was one question I was thinking of. But the other was, I was fascinated by chapter 29 of the book, which listed essentially 10 ways in which the US suffers from our caste system that compared to other developed and prosperous countries, we have horrible statistics on, prisons, on birth, on age of mortality. The list went on, and it
healthcare,
of course, it doesn't compare. That the price that this country has paid for its caste system has been extraordinary and is ongoing. And my thought was, well, if that information were more fully appreciated, it might make it easier in the interest, I don't know, self-interest for the country to re-examine its caste system. But in that context also, I began thinking about going back to, is it inevitable? The very well-developed countries that our model is often the Scandinavian countries, that they manage to have a social welfare, and it seems that they are more equitable and that they don't discriminate and don't have a caste system. But in the last 40 or 50 years, as they have imported immigrant workers from other countries, those immigrant workers have become their lower caste, it seems to me. So I don't know.
No, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's wonderful. Let's hear from Don, and then Cordell, maybe you can address Francine and Gary's talk, and maybe that chapter, you know, about how America is hurt. Don, can you go ahead and talk to us?
Sure. My thought is related to what Fran was just saying, and we've broached this subject several times when we bring in class and power as variables or dynamics affecting how the caste system expresses itself. But I think we need to focus explicitly on money as a measure of power and class. And I think that I'm wondering if we were able to move in our own country, for example, toward greater or less inequality of income and financial resources, if we were really able to correct the gross imbalances that are existing now, if that might move us in the direction of breaking some of the constraints of caste, might loosen some of the bonds.
I think that's the elephant in the room, Don. I think that's money is absolutely the elephant in the room. Nori in the chat said, if caste is based on power and power is based on money in the US. Cordell, in the book, does Ms. Wilkerson talk about the money side of it? I mean, if we had money, we see rappers who the people wouldn't even give the time of day, who got wealthy and now are supposedly in this different caste,
I think it's complex. To the one question about, is caste inevitable? Just to touch on that, I think that what came up in my mind was, do you feel small? Do you feel like you don't have power? I think those who feel small are somehow threatened are more vulnerable to this solution than those who feel like they're fine and are not threatened. So if you look at where the energy is for oppression and looking for favor, is those trying to rise more than any other group, trying to rise. And so they want to make a wall. They want to make a bottom. They want to establish a bottom and then go from there up. So I think a driver is back to the scarcity model. If you're uncomfortable and feeling threatened and endangered, you take these kind of measures. I'm not sure the economic situation in Scandinavia that might comply with this model or not, but I also believe that in periods where we've had bounty, like in the 60s, maybe right after the war, we got the war benefit, we were open to a lot of things. We were able to advance some of the civil rights agenda at that time. We were more willing to, say, spend a few dollars to fix something. When things get scarce, we begin worrying about deficits and debt and all those kinds of things. So money is in the story, and caste is still a strategy. I don't think it's in the genes. I think that when we're comfortable, we're ready to embrace. And when we're not comfortable, then we're ready to fight. And that seems to me what, in my observation, even though that's not exactly what Isabel wrote, that's not the point she tried to make. But she did talk about how we squander human value, human wealth. We don't know among those we failed to educate who might have brought us enormous gifts and benefits. But since we can't quantify it, you may say that it's true and it may be self-evident to some of us, but I don't think it motivates collectives to go, well, let's just see if we put a lot of money into this group, if they save the world and cure cancer and save the planet from, fossil fuel. They're not thinking that way. And I think they still believe that they're self-sufficient. And so long as they are in control, they can fix whatever they need to fix, I think is the reflexive behavior.
Cordell, Christina, do you mind, and Bob, holding for a second? I really want to hear from Ajit, because I want to ask him, as a brown man in a country that treats brown people in a certain way, what some of your experiences have been, because you're in tech. And I'm just really curious about that side, if you feel comfortable talking about.
It's funny, Lonnie, that you pointed to me, because I was actually going to turn something that Cordell said earlier on back into this conversation of whether it's all about money and is that the only reason. Cordell, you started off by saying, I walk in, in your profession, you walk into this room, right? And then people wonder why you're there. Right. We're all, I think, in that room, I would at least like to assume that we're all in the same economic class. Yes, question is raised. And it has happened to me too, right? It's not like I've come from a position of poverty or anything else. but like I've seen living in the East Coast and also in the Bay Area, we like to think we're immune to this in the Bay Area, but I don't think we are. But yes, like I don't think it's completely just about money. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of rich tech people. There are a lot of people, and I see it in the job environment, right? Where even in the Bay Area, like I've seen it where there is a difference in which how you're treated, if whether you are brown, black, or white. Mm. I've personally seen it. And we make a big push now in our company to say that what is diversity and inclusion and what does it mean? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a little bit of element of money, but it doesn't explain everything.
Okay.
But self-interest is the modifier. Yeah. When I come into the room, if I come into the meeting, and if I'm the Michael Jordan of software,
sure.
You know, Michael Jordan was as black as you want.
Sure.
But if it helps us win the pennant, we'll overlook the fact that he's black. The guy can play basketball. And so those kind of decisions are made. And we have a number of us who get a chance to play in these other environments, but it's only because we're going to pay for ourselves and there's nobody like us.
But Cordell, I'll also throw that back at you. Between Michael Jordan being the greatest basketball player and accepting him as a basketball player, what happens if he wants to marry into a rich Southern white family?
He can do it, but they have to marry out back. I'm sorry, it doesn't go away. They've said that where we have these great artists who will come to you, entertain you with unequal, unparalleled beauty. And mm-hmm. yet they can't eat with you. They can't. I mean, we've done that for multiple generations. So there is not, this is not rational. It's this not. Is the fact that, again, we build it into our bodies. We build it into our feelings. And that's why I started out talking about where are the roots of it? The roots are the feelings that happen before we've actually become cognitive. We end up in a position before we're cognitive. And then some of us can push it back. But that's not the norm.
That's one of the things that the LFDC has done with Camille in having our MOBs, our moments of unconscious bias, that, you know, some people push back on it when we first started, like it felt like a guilt talk, but it wasn't. It was raising up in a community of love those unconscious things, which we now realize. So the LFDC, through all of that process and the books that we read and the honesty that we, with which we talk to each other, is softening that thing, Cordell, is bringing that up to consciousness. Christina, and then Bob, and then Kathy. Christina, you're already unmuted. You can just talk.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to take my hand down. Cordell started this with wanting us to go to a heart place. And I think that that is what Ms. Wilkinson wanted us to do as well. And I think getting, there's nothing wrong with our discussion, but it's very much in our heads and definitions and stuff. What got to me in this book was on a feeling level as well as an intellectual level. She went through stories and detail of brutality. We all think we know as white people, slavery was brutal. There have been lynchings. We know that up here. I happened to be listening to this book, so I couldn't speed read through pages. I had to listen to everything she said, and she goes through a lot of stories of lynching, which is torture and evil and slavery and practices. And you get it on a heart level that maybe you thought you got before, but you didn't, as a white person. The enforcement of this, and also that it is on the unconscious level. Michael Jordan could have gone across the street and had something happen to him. Granted, he was probably pretty tall, so maybe not. But as a black person, he could have, black male, he could have any number of things happened to him once he walked out of that stadium. Rappers who get rich, I'm sure they keep somebody next to them as a bodyguards now that they can afford it. there just is a whole system going on that is in our unconscious, and that we can only do something better about along the lines of the story that she ends the book with her encounter with this plumber, in which she brings up the death of her mother and whether he lost his mother. And suddenly they're two people of a similar age and everything changes. So I must say that through all these horrors of what she talks about, it was horrific and stomach churning. But it was the story with the plumber where I started to cry, because that's how it could be. That's how it should be. And that's how, as little children, we are by nature, is that we have this human connection with each other. But the enforcement of the caste system from the get-go and the unconscious pervasiveness of it is, using the word caste is so useful to make it how far it permeates our consciousness. More than class, more than visual seeing race, it is automatic. And I think of John Hope Franklin, an eminent African-American history professor, at the dinner honoring his retirement as a gray-haired man, some white woman walked up and handed him her coat, you know, as if he were the porter, the doorman, something.
Thank you, Christy.
It just is. It's big.
Bob, I'm going to ask you if you could hold, only because we haven't heard from Kathy and Jim and Megan. Are you okay with that, Sweetie? Thank you. Kathy, can you unmute and just give us your...
Oh, thanks, Lonnie. Thank you so much, Cordell, for this wonderful unpacking. I feel so much better since the heart-wrenching movie Another World. My engineering society has a diversity, equity, and inclusion group, and that was one of our assignments, is to actually, you know, if you haven't read it, there was that movie. So anyway, I'm not going to go into that, but I really resonate with a lot of what Christina just said about that plumber moment. I think it doesn't even have to be that extensive. I think it could be small moments, such as I'm on the BART train or Muni, and there's an empty seat next to a Black person. I sit there, and it's actually some of my most interesting conversations, because I don't deny my privilege as a petite Asian woman. I am probably the least threatening looking person in society. I don't have to worry whether a cop's going to shoot me dead, but I can normalize, you know, touching the same bar as a Black person, because I see that bubble of politeness. I mean, a lot of normal people would call it politeness, but it is that ingrained moment of unconscious bias that I am actively looking for opportunities to undo by grabbing the bar, sitting next to them. I even remembered in my 20s going into a Nordstrom elevator, and a bunch of Black teenage kids came in, and I could tell that they get that, you know, body shirk all the time, like what Cordell's dog experience talks about, where I just turn around and it's acceptable for me to go around and say, hey, how's it going? You know, and I shake each of their hands so that they don't have to put up that front of, oh my goodness, it's all these Black people. Oh my gosh, I hope you're not afraid, that kind of thing. So I know they were poking fun at me, but I just, you know, flashed the warmest smile I possibly could. And I think these small gestures every single day, I think, you know, if we could do our part to at least notice that and then counteract it that way, I think that's at least my two cents in how we can help undo and normalize. And because a lot of really awful, you know, systems have been put in place, but that's my small patch. But that being said, I think my comment in the chat was about mainstream news keeping us divided. They don't have Trump. Trump was their fodder to keep us all divided and keep the Trumpians hating us elitists. When we have so much in common, we have, you know, we think everybody should be able to have a meal. We don't think people should be thrown out on the streets. There's just so much common ground, but there are the forces that's actively keeping us divided. So we should keep that in mind too. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Hey, Jim, and then Megan, you want to unmute, sweetie?
Yeah, where's it?
I can hear you. I don't know.
Jim, try it one more time, Jim. Let me. Jim, I'm going to put a message on the screen that says ask to unmute.
There
okay.
you go. There you go.
Go ahead, Jim.
My old tablet is recalcitrant sometimes. It won't be. So when you're talking about Michael Jordan and the limits of how achieve a certain position, what those limits can be, there's a couple of movies that have shown one Netflix, I believe, and one Amazon Prime. First is One Night in Miami. It's a fictionalized version of an actual get together of four of the most prominent black men of the era after Cassius Clay won the championship of the world, heavyweight title, championship, yeah. Shortly before he came out as a Muslim and changed his name. And they gather in this hotel room and just have conversations, but the movie starts with some scenes before that, and one of them is Jim Brown coming to visit this well-to-do, prominent white man, I think, you know, whatever state, perhaps North Carolina, and this man invites him out to his front porch. The man's wife serves him lemonade, and they have this nice discussion. We're so proud of you for representing our county and becoming this amazing superstar football player. And then his wife comes out and says she needs help moving a piece of furniture. Jim Brown offers to help. And the man says, we don't allow, the N-word in our house. And it's like, just it showed the limits of his acceptance as a, as this amazing, prominent black man. And the another part of it is two of those four men were dead within a year or two after that. Sam Cooke under mysterious circumstances and Malcolm X after being assassinated. So it was just a very powerful movie. Another one was Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which you probably heard of as well. It's a powerful expression, showing Ma Rainey making loads of money for this record company. She had to keep fighting and clawing to get respected by the people who were making all this money from her. So sometimes drama and art can be more powerful than just reading nonfiction about people's lives in certain ways.
Thank you, Jim. And just for everybody to know that Jim Acock has devoted hours and hours, as well as Randall Hudson and others on this call, to helping homeless youth build tiny houses in Oakland. Your level of commitment, Jim, we're just so grateful to you, and the children are grateful to you, and Randall, thank you so much. Really, thank you. Megan, can you talk to us?
Yeah, I was just, this is way off the flow of the topics, but because I'm an infant specialist, I think, I just was thinking about in her documentation of all the prohibitions against touch, the pollution stuff, I was thinking about the role of so many Black women in nurturing the children, the infants and toddlers, especially of white people, and which continues, of course, and the kind of paradox around that, because of course attachment would develop, there was love there too, and yet maybe it had to do with devaluing young children. I'm not sure, on the part of the whites. I just don't understand it. I don't understand how that went, because I know that there were early relationships there, and then that's very early experience of the white children experiencing love for the Black women that were nurturing them, and then that must have had to be have been compensated so severely. I mean, I'm just wondering about how all of that went. And then I was thinking, she did touch on this other kind of related issue, but then I haven't been able to locate where it was in the book, the pressure on Black women to comfort white people. And, it's kind of come up in a lot of the conversations about racism, things I've been involved with too, you know, white women crying and all of that. But those are kind of just series of wonderings about things that stood out for me because of the nature of my work. And the fact that Black women and also Latinas are also very, very prevalent still in taking care of infants and toddlers in all of our communities at very poor wages, at not even living, you know, wages, you know, I mean, and so it just kind of, that role continues.
I think Megan, exactly what you're saying about caste, it pulls back to that, that these children suckled at the breasts of Black women.
Right.
That whole point is that, you know, children suckled, these were their mammies, and then they grow up and they call them the N-word because of the caste rules that we started off the conversation with. I just want to raise up, and then we're going to go on to Nori, and then Bob, we're doing you, and then Cordell, if you can sum up some of the positive things that we could take from this. But I just want to let everybody know that Megan Kirschbaum is our queen here in terms of working with infants and families, and just got an award from the Berkeley Center for Independent Living, Ed Roberts Award. And Megan, your work in the community is unparalleled for so many years in the disability community. Thank you so much. Nori, can you unmute? And then we're going to go to Bob, Nori, and then Bob, and then Cordell. Give us some hope.
I just, well, maybe it's sort of, I've sort of been posting in the chat about all the classism in my family and racism. But I just wanted to tell the story of, like, when I was on the subway, you made me think of this, Kathy, but I was on the subway and I was in one of the facing chairs to the other two chairs. And there was a young man and his girlfriend, I guess, or somebody. Anyway, he was very upset. And he took his fist and smashed at the window. He didn't break it or anything. And so I'm sitting there. Of course, as soon as he gets upset like this, all the phones come out. All the phones come out in the car, right? You know? And so I'm trying to talk to him, you know, and he said, "My mother just died, you know, and have you lost your mother?" And, you know, being really, really angry at me, you know, and stuff. And I kept talking to him and he said, "Well, you know, I have ADHD. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I do too." And I just think I could have kept talking to him like another human being, but oh no, next stop, there they were, and there he is out on the station within handcuffs.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was just, it made me so sad. You know, I wanted to get out of wasn't able to get out fast enough onto that station to say, you know, he's just terribly upset about the death of his mother. Why are you handcuffing him? I also, knowing as myself, I have sort of PTSD and I can get very angry. And I just think, you know, if I weren't a white person, I'd be in jail. I would, you know, and so anyway, I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Nori. Thank you, those. Thank you. Bob, are you still around, my dear?
Hi, thank you. Somebody was talking about, we got the subject about Black people with privilege, and talking about Michael Jordan. Let us not forget that his father was killed in a carjacking. So even though there was great family wealth at that point, his father was not immune from being treated as just some common somebody to carjack and shoot and kill. I wanted to jump back to the more on the systemic side of things and make a point about
that our I'm going to put it out there, our participation in home ownership, of which I am one, we're part of the system that is deprives Black and other people of housing, decent housing. It's, you know, we experience it here in the Bay Area. It's called yuppie displacement, but it's you know, it's not just a change in income levels, it's a change in who the people are and what is the color of their skin, largely, not entirely, but largely the color of their skin. And that as homeowners, we're part of that system. And Black people have struggled for forever, ever since the 40 acres and a mule was overturned by President Johnson, that Black people are yet to be seen, even with all the efforts, all the campaigns we've done about redlining and greenlining and all of that, as deserving a home. And so are end up being renters. I mean, one of the differences between where we live and the El Cerrito, Albany, Berkeley, Kensington area, and Richmond is the areas we live in are largely, substantially home ownership areas, and Richmond is still not a home ownership area. And we participate in this. So this idea of us being we're part of a caste system that's functioning right around us all the time, every day, you know, semi-pleasantly. Real estate people are always very pleasant about all of this, but you know, this is people projected as being something that happens over there. It doesn't. It's so close to us all the time. And I think the idea about recognizing it is, you don't have to read a book about other people's problems to begin to look around, open your eyes and look around. Or as Nori said, have the courage to get out of the BART car yourself and go stand and be a witness next to the cops with this person, which I've done versions of that when I was younger. I haven't done one recently, but I'm sure the opportunity will come again because the problem will be there again.
Thank you, Bob. I have a question, and Cordell, I would love for you to talk to us about, you know, some of the solutions in the book, but we're a covenantal group here in Sacred. And the fact is, for the centuries of deprivation have resulted in a group that is now very desperate, sections of a group that is very desperate. You and I, Cordell, do not go to East Oakland at a certain hour of the day. That's just reality. For what has happened over time with this caste system, we know that there is danger from groups. So this is now reinforced by a media that has made that and a system that has made that be so. So we're asking people, okay, get rid of your unconscious stuff. Yet now there is stuff that to be afraid of because it's been made to happen. I would love for you to talk about that from the heart that we all have to deal with now. Just like I don't want to be around the skinhead and the Proud Boys and those coal miner kids that didn't grow up with education, and because they're dangerous because of the caste system that they've been in, so too we have people. Okay, I'll stop there.
So my metaphor for these communities goes back to the drowning person. A person who's drowning cannot be expected to behave while you rescue them. They're flailing. They're going to grab whatever is close to their hand to keep them afloat. That's not a good place to be in. Even to ask for help is not a good place to be in. If you just be calm, take a deep breath, and just lay back for a second, I'll get you out of this deep water. So we don't appreciate the desperation in these communities. And that's unfortunate because in our own comfort, we make comfort-based judgments about the decisions other people make. And we're almost always wrong. And sadly, in our wealthy society, we don't just put a safety net out, catch people, set them on their feet, prepare them to be valuable contributors to our society because we blame them for their condition. And that's a historical problem. If you remember 13, the idea was to criminalize this population so we could put them in the penal system and get them slaves again. And so everything is about that perception that we're dangerous and criminal and et cetera. So that's one focal component. If we were to address the messaging, the narrative, we can at least prepare ourselves for the compassionate response without the judgments that we get from our programming. And the way to get that, I begin, is like, unless we stand in the shoes and go, a policeman is aiming at my back right now, what am I gonna do? If we don't get there and try to get the feeling of it, we can't get the emotions to respond. I believe that we have to get out of the comfort zone. I don't have another explanation. Now, in the book, Isabel talked about the human heart, and we've seen the human heart in children. Children, when they're born, they're toddlers. One falls and gets a boo-boo. The closest one comes and puts their arm around them and go, it's gonna be, they do what they respond instinctively as human beings are wired to do. Sadly, we train that out of people when we're building the caste model. We put a penalty on helping the wrong people. If you remember the book, Learning to Be White, the price of being a good white person is high, meaning racially unbiased, helpful, even trying to understand the plight of the other is dangerous to white people. So learning to be white is part of the problem. So in our community, my thought is we have to become not so delicate, and we've got to use our voices and our resources. So the reason that caste systems work is because as a species, we try to reach consensus. We are socially built to try to reach consensus, agreement. We need to change what we're agreeing on. Let's work on changing what we're agreeing to do. We can do that in our community. Maybe we can teach other communities to do it, but I don't know. There's no secret except for, let's say we have to draw a line. Let's own the history. Let's go, that was horrible. Look at what we have done. Let's leave that. What's it gonna cost us? $3 trillion. Okay, let's put it on the table and let's do it. If we don't find the courage to do that, we're fooling ourselves. There's no trick. We have to support people while they're drowning. We've got to get them out of the deep water. There's no trick. We have to do it. So everybody's got to find the way to find in, not look across to the TV, to the politician. We've got to take a piece of that and go, I'm going to do this. Consensus, agreement that we have something to fix. We've got to do it. So that's why a church community to me is part of the solution, because we can in our group become visible on a new track, visible in a new track, strident if it takes that. Reach out to other churches and see if we can't compel or at least have a voice in that community. We don't have any choices here. There's no trick. Either you're helping or you're not. So we all now from this book can understand that a nation can be evil and some of the people not. But those people who are not are kept in the blinders are on them so they don't rock the boat. So you have to start ripping the blinders off. We have to use social platforms to make it clear that we're in the wrong and we have work to do and we've got to step up and do it. There's no secret. And watching the plumber, reading the chapter on the plumber also gave me heart, because it still reminds me that even on either side of the line, if we presume humanity somewhere in there and reach for it, so that in the apartheid, in the end of apartheid in South Africa, there was truth and reconciliation. One side had to go tell the truth. We did these terrible things. They had to tell the truth to everyone. The other side had to go, that was terrible what you did, but I have to be prepared to forgive. We both have a chasm to cross. Different, but emotional work inside. if we are to have a chance, I think that's the model. But I believe that I cannot write off any human being. I have always had this fantasy, and I know I'm probably wrong, but I watch on the news somebody doing some horrendous thing, and I, in that moment, want to be there. I want to stand in front of somebody and go, look at me. I want to look at me. I'm a human being, and I want to stand there till they see me. And I know I could be dead trying to do that. But that's my instinct, is to give them a chance to see the humanity. That's the only thing that works. That's the only common ground that we have is in us, deep in us is a heart that it knows how to be human. And I might have to knock some rust off of it, but it's in there. The plumber had it. He was not that guy in the beginning. He was like, I'm not my problem. I'm getting ready to walk out of here any minute now and your house can blow up for all I'm concerned, but he had a mother. There's stuff that we have to be prepared to be courageous enough to use. So we have to build consensus. So we have to be powerful messengers. We should craft messages so that we know we can avoid all the pit holes as much as possible and get to the relevant and impactful messaging and be as good as marketing companies who sell you Coke that's not good for you or whatever. We have to be as good as they are at taking the messages where they have to go. We have to be prepared to forgive and then reprogram. I'm a programmer, so I'm going to go there. We have to forgive and we have to be prepared to program. We should have the best programmers at our church for human hearts as good as Microsoft programmers are for computers. We have to commit. We've got people in our community who understand that. We've got to have a program in our church that's about that, that's replicable. So you can take the model and spread it. But there's no, we've already been told by the masters what it is. We just have to do it. That's all. So I'm down to consensus. I'm down to telling the truth. Let's decide we're going to rebuild the kingdom on earth, or as I got corrected in the service today, the loving community. I think Michelle said kingdom started to not be the right word, but the loving community of planet Earth. We've got to decide that we're going to make that happen, and we've got to do whatever that is, if it means all the money. That's the problem. We think there's a comfortable line. There is no line. It's whatever it takes. And so our community can hold that. We can tell the truth. We can commit. But we have to be smart about the inner work. We have to be smart about how the heart works. We've got to step out to people who are not on that team, on our team, and open our arms and be prepared to bring them in. So we could have a cast that builds heaven on earth, which is actually a one-layer cast. We could make that happen. I will say it because if you can program bad, you can program good. So we're programmers now, everybody. I just signed you on. You're all programmers. And you program human beings. Get good at it. Get good at it. You should not meet somebody that when you walk away, they're not smiling and somehow feeling better. I'm going to stop. Thank you.
Cordell, if I may, you basically reminded me, I don't know if you've heard of Daryl Davis or not, but you basically evoked him. I don't know if he's still around. Have you heard of Daryl Davis?
I don't know Daryl Davis.
He is a jazz musician that in the 80s, in 60 Minutes, when I was a kid, I watched Mike Wallace interview him. He found out the Grand Wizard identity of a Ku Klux Klansman who just got out, was about to get out of prison because he was about to shoot he attempted to murder two Black men, basically. So he had his secretary get in touch with him and request an interview. I'm going to make this short. In the end, he ended up befriending this Grand Wizard. And you see this video footage from the 80s, it's kind of grainy. But this Grand Wizard, he was invited to a Klan rally. He was actually welcomed there by the Grand Wizard. Wow. And he told this whole crowd that was booing him, saying, I have respect, more respect for this Black man than any of you out there. And I was like, oh my God. And so he was basically asked, how long did it take from when you started talking to him? Because the Klansmen and some of the other Klansmen started going to his jazz concert. So he sounds like you, Cordell. jazz musician. So anyway, it took him 6.5 years from when he first met this Grand Wizard, I forgot his name, till when this Grand Wizard finally gave him his Grand Wizard uniform. He quit the Ku Klux Klan. So he ended up giving a TED talk. So look him up, Daryl Davis, D-A-R-Y-L Davis, D-A-V-I-S.
I wrote it down.
Very interesting.
To your point about programming, we have our new board of trustees is on the screen. Cordell Sloan has come back. We now have Bill Brown. We have Randall Hudson. We have Helen Tinsley Jones. We have the folks in place, and we have our Ariel Smith, IR. Thank you, Ariel. In place to say, okay, we're putting out a policy of reprogramming. So we have the people that we've asked to step up and help us do this. Sitting there on the board. This is an amazing, amazing time, an amazing group of people. We're at time. Where's my dear Camille, who, thank you, dearest. Camille, can you close us out, sweetie? And you have come off of mute. This LFDC has just been part of the reprogramming of all of us. And just want to have you close this out today.
Well, put me on the spot, girlfriend.
we can just say thank you if you don't feel like saying anything.
Thank you. I really appreciate everybody's participation this afternoon. That book was something for me. It was very, very painful to read. And I really wanted to have this meeting so I can hear whatever other people had to say. And I appreciate all of your participation.
Yes.
And I don't know which football team to root for, but go whoever. next up is the Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek. That's with Dorothy Herzberg. So take a look.
All right.
Thank you, Camille. Thank you, Camille.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
For your presence. Your presence matters. Your presence matters.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cordell. Thank you, Lonnie. Yes. Thank you, Camille.
Thank you, everybody.
Good to see you, Kathy.
Have a good day.